It's Thursday, July 25th, 2013, and you're listening to episode 305 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 50 minutes. I'm looking this over to somebody else. Joanna, as I look at your Kickstarter, your rewards were very much related directly to the primary product. Additional episodes for the season, guest appearances within the seasons. These are things that, you know, were going to directly affect the production that you guys had to do. Obviously, when you go to produce those things along the stretch goals, you've raised the money by virtue of reaching the stretch goals, but there is still obviously going to be some amount of time and effort and infrastructure. And I'm curious, is that something that you guys planned for? Is this something that now on the other side of it, there's going to be a bit of a scramble on? Where are you guys at on that?
Well, we kind of did a combination on our Kickstarter. Instead of aiming for the amount that we needed to make a season that we would be happy with in terms of length, we instead aimed for a much lower point. So we aimed for $12,000 as our base goal. But that $12,000 was only two episodes in season three rolled into a 20-minute short film. So basically, if all we did was meet our goal in our Kickstarter and nothing else, then we would close up the story, but that was about it. And then we lined it up so that we were hitting stretch goals to get more episodes. And yeah, it was one of those things where we didn't actually know how well we were going to do on the Kickstarter. And so we thought, okay, well, since we don't have flexible funding this time, we'll aim low and see if we can hit stretch goals on the way up. And then we kind of tried to model it a little bit after the Reaper thing. Everybody quotes the Reaper thing because it was an amazing campaign where we basically picked a backer level. For us, it was the $25 level. And we tried to make it so that if we hit more stretch goals, that $25 backer level, everybody who was already there got more. One of the big things that we lined up for them there was we have a standard action Pathfinder module that everybody at the $25 level got if we hit the $20,000 stretch goal. And then we had sort of music, we had like RPG supplements we had going on there. So basically a lot of digital perks that we could send out to those people if we hit stretch goals, which encouraged them to sort of tell their friends and get more people to back. In terms of, yeah, the length of the season and in terms of the guest star appearances and that kind of thing, a lot of those costs are soft costs for sure. I mean, we did our best to estimate exactly how much that kind of stuff would cost us. But when it comes to scheduling people from out of town and the increase in scope that comes with extra episodes, yeah, we did our best. We're doing okay. I think we basically estimated relatively well, and we're still going to be all right with the money that we got. But it's always close, especially with something like film production. You never know when you're going to hit a really big snag and something has to change drastically.
Did you ever have the fear when you were doing things like guest stars that this person's going to get all the way out here and they will be the worst actor ever?
Yeah, absolutely. It, to the point where I didn't invite anybody on as a guest star that I didn't know. The people who were inviting on as guest stars, most of them I have worked with before. I know that they're great people. A lot of them are from Zombie Orpheus Entertainment, who are the guys who make Journey Quest and the Gamers movies. And I've met them. I know that they're decent people. I know that they're good actors. I tried to hedge my bets as well as I could on that one. I mean, if you don't know who you're working with, for example, you can do something like offer them a voice appearance rather than an actual on-set appearance. That's much easier to deal with if you don't know who they are.
Tom, we haven't heard anything from you or Bill in a while. I'll just go and throw out both names because I don't know what I'm actually going to call you.
Yes.
Let's talk about setting up reward levels. When you were creating your Kickstarter, what was the process that you went through in terms of deciding what to offer at each level? And I'm asking this from two angles. One, how do you actually come up with the sorts of items that people are going to be interested in getting? And we've talked about this a little bit, but I think we could still expound on a little more. But then secondly, how do you also decide what each of those are worth?
Well, I think there's two parts to your question there. And one of them is definitely about, as Joanna mentioned, kind of gearing a sweet spot for people to back. I think every successful Kickstarter, you go, okay, well, this is the primary level. I got to get in on this level because the value of what they're offering is so compelling. Ryan talked about some promotional things that they did to get people to buy into their project and initially pledge. But those last couple of days specifically, an arrangement of stretch goals, one component of that whole thing is to try and get people to not only pledge at a particular level, but maybe increase their pledge at a particular level. So, for instance, you know, we started piling on stretch goals to incentivize people to pledge at, say, the $50 level instead of $25. And so a lot of the activity that we saw at the very last minute was not just people coming on saying, I got to get in on this before the clock ticks out, but also I want to increase my pledge level. I pledged at the $10 level, or you'll see people pledge at the $1 level just so they can get all the backer updates and then at the last minute crank things up. So I think that's part of your strategy, is look at your goals and the things that you want to offer and see where that offers a compelling value. In my particular case, we sat down and we looked at it and we said, okay, there's a group of people that we have to ship physical goods to. So we want to create incentives that we can provide physically for that level. Shipping cost is a huge part of organizing any Kickstarter. And then secondly, we're like, okay, who are the people who want just e-delivery, who are maybe not, you know, necessarily able to pledge at, you know, $100 or whatever it is? What can we offer them? And I think in determining my Kickstarter rewards, I based it on my own experience of backing 24 projects over the course of the past year and a half or whatever it has been, and seeing, you know, okay, well, I'm a gamer, so what would I want? And what do I find as a compelling value? And then B, where do we slot that in and deliver that?
And your answer was a horrible dungeon crawl.
You know, we talked earlier about, you know, whether this was a test of the fans, and Ryan is like, that's absolutely one of our, you know, missions with their particular Kickstarter. And I have to say, that was also something with ours. We haven't done a Kickstarter or asked for any funding prior to this, and it was a test of the fan base to see, okay, how engaged are people, how much, and not only that, but we named it literally the world's worst dungeon crawl. So we got 500 people to say, I believe in the worst thing that you could put in a role-playing game. You know, some people get the tongue-in-cheek point, and maybe it was lost on some other people, but it was definitely, you know, a piece of validation for us as a franchise and as an idea. On the flip side, I think one of the challenges that I faced in naming it that was that there's probably 25,000 gamers who are like, I've already played in the world's worst dungeon crawl. Why would I pledge money to that? So it was an interesting kind of marketing challenge, right?
So did any of you guys, and I'm just opening this one wide open, did any of you guys ask people within your fans base or whatever and say, if we go out and create this Kickstarter, what would you guys like to see? What kinds of things would you want to pay money for? Or did you just kind of create it and see what stuck?
I just free-falled it myself. I did a lot of research to see what other people were doing for similar kinds of projects, and then just came up with it my own. But I think just doing the homework, I think that sets you apart from a lot of the failures in Kickstarter. You know, being able to sit down and say, I actually looked and saw what people were purchasing and what good ideas were being put out there and what got people excited about projects in my category. But I think a lot of the ones that fail don't bother to do that at all. They just kind of say, well, we think the book should be worth, you know, $500 each, and they're going to be covered in gold and the blood of virgins and all this, and just go. Don't do that.
I do think that people who are coming to Kickstarter for the first time as creators also get kind of an overblown sense sometimes of, because they've seen successful projects and they don't pay attention to the ones that have failed, they set the successful ones as their benchmark. You'll see these ridiculous initial asks of, you know, well, we need $50,000 to do this. And it's like, if you're just an out-of-the-blue creator that I don't know and I don't recognize, 50 grand is a tough goal to hit.
Yeah, I mentioned I've backed about 10. When I think about it, I personally knew 4 of the 10 creators, and I knew the companies and had yeah. reputation of a couple of the others. So I can't really see myself just jumping out there and backing just anybody unless it's a really interesting idea.
Let's go back to Kickstarter's own statistics. 56% of Kickstarters will fail. Not fail to deliver, be late or whatever, they will not reach their funding goals, 56% of them. And within that 56%, you know, as I showed you guys earlier, over 80% of those won't even make it past the 20% mark. And so I think you need to know coming into this that you're being somewhat realistic. One of the things that I have observed as I watch Kickstarters go out there, there are people who unfortunately have a marketing plan that consists of it going viral. That's effectively their plan. These are people that may not have any established name, may not have any really good social network to get the word out, may not have any reputation. And rather than coming in at a reasonable goal where somebody might say, okay, I'll kind of back this to see where it goes, they come in asking for $20,000. By the end of it, 30, 45, 60, whatever days later, out of that $20,000, they've raised like 750. And I kind of look at this and it's like, you know, I would love to say that I'm surprised, but I'm not. It's like, you know, you really radically overreached yourself there.
Well, and to just to build on the earlier point, I feel like Kickstarter, more than anything else, is an exercise in pure marketing, right? I mean, you literally have no product. You may have a prototype if you're lucky, but it's an exercise in pure marketing. And so people don't know about failed projects because the reason the projects failed is because people didn't know about them. Yeah. In Hollywood here, where people are always scaring you with the story of like, well, you got to be the top actor that you can be because there's 400 people getting off the bus at Hollywood Highland every Monday afternoon who've come here to make their fortune. You got to keep up. And what you don't see is the 90% of the people who are failing or treading water or not succeeding and who are packing up their U-Haul and moving back to Nebraska because they're tired of it. All you see is the successes, and I think that's part of the thing at Kickstarter is like, could you name four projects that have failed? I don't think I could name four projects that have failed because you haven't heard of them.
Yeah, I think people going into it too, they have this really overinflated sense of how easy it must be because they see these Kickstarters that obviously, you know, as Tom's saying, they're the ones that you hear about, so they're the ones that are doing well, and they'll go and they'll look at them and maybe they'll back them and they'll say, oh yeah, this is where I want to get the money for my project because look, you can get $60,000 here, you know, for a game. Wow, that sounds good. And they don't actually see the amount of work that goes behind it. And so I've talked to a bunch of people who are, you know, artists like myself, people who are trying to get film projects on the go, people who are trying to do board games, that kind of thing. And they put up these Kickstarters that are just so incredibly ambitious, and then they just step back and leave them. And it's just sort of like they put it up on the web, walk away, construct their perks, and then just wait for the money to roll in. And people don't really understand the vast amount of work that goes into a Kickstarter. I mean, when people ask me, I'm like, well, if you're not working on it every single day, you're probably not doing enough work. And a lot of people just don't get it until they fail their first time.
That's actually something where I'm going to have to give Palladium credit. One of the things that I really appreciated that they did with the Robotech Minis game is when they brought that to Kickstarter, it was fundamentally done. You know, they said, look, this is not something where you're just taking a risk that we will hopefully produce this someday. They actually had the product. And from what I understand, the Kickstarter was really there not so much to fund its creation as to fund its refinement and distribution and production. When I say production, I don't mean production as in writing it. I mean as in actually, you know, stamping out all the little Veritex and shipping them out and whatnot. But they came with really a completed product already in hand. And Joanna, if I look at something like in your case, you know, granted, you may not per se have had season three in hand when you came to the Kickstarter. That was the point of the Kickstarter. But you did go to that Kickstarter with season one and two in hand. And so there was some amount of established reputation there in terms of who you were and what you could do. I can say this all across the board. I mean, Matt Forbeck, this was not your first time to the dance in terms of writing something, obviously.
Yeah, but you know, honestly, I had nothing. I was pitching ideas, right?
Well, see, I don't know that I would say you had nothing because once again, you may have had nothing on that product, but you still had a long history of many other things within, you know, that sphere of publication and gaming and fiction and whatever.
Sure.
You know, this was not your opening salvo. Yeah, you know, and no. I can say the same thing about all of you. There's not a single person on here where the Kickstarter was the opening salvo of your career. You know, every one of you had some amount of history, some amount of reputation prior to attempting a Kickstarter.
Right. Yeah, I often call Kickstarter a trust economy, right? Because what you're really trading upon is the amount of trust that you've established for yourself. And you can usually do that in one of two ways. The first way, the longest way, is to develop a reputation. Right. And that's what I ended up doing myself, where I was able to come to people and say, OK, I've done this before. You guys know me. You can look at all the books on my shelf behind me here and you can tell that I'm going to deliver this thing. Now, if you want to look at somebody else who did it a different way, Jeremy Keller did a game called Tech Noir about 2 years ago. And he came out of nowhere. I had never heard of Jeremy before, but he did such a kick ass pitch video. It looked like something out of Minority Report. And Jeremy's day job is doing videos like that. So when it came to actually pitching what he was doing, even though he was a newbie as far as publishing went, as far as game design went, his graphic design skills and presentation skills were fantastic. And he showed such a passion in his video that he overfunded by like 1,000%, I think. It was fantastic.
Let's talk about that pitch video, because I think that is an important thing. I don't know what the current statistic is, but in years past, I'd heard analysis of online dating, and they had found that profiles that included a picture were some huge number of times more likely to be read and responded to than those that did not have a picture. I once talked to an attorney, he's a criminal defense attorney, who said that he felt it was important, if it was possible, to put his client on the stand because the jury wants to see the person, know the person, and hear him or her say, I didn't do it. And in the same way, when you go out to do a Kickstarter, that pitch video, especially if you're someone who's something of an unknown, is your best way of really making an appeal to people, give them something to connect with, to make them feel good about and excited about that project. And, you know, I can talk about several great ones I've seen. The one that Brian Fargo did for Wasteland 2 was an absolutely awesome pitch video. Even if you don't like Wasteland, look up the Wasteland 2 Kickstarter and watch his pitch video. It is freaking hilarious. One of our hosts, John Grana, when he did Blood Moon Goblins, which was a Pathfinder supplement, he did an outstanding job.
That's right. He asked me to be in it.
In fact, we kind of screwed up the taping because while we were taping it, I was the one videotaping, and he started cracking me up when we had trouble cutting the video because I'm laughing in the background while he's trying to do it.
I think that's a double-edged sword, though, because I've seen Kickstarters that seem to focus their whole campaign around the pitch video. And if I'm looking at it on my phone or, say, at work where, like, YouTube may be blocked, or
right.
I don't always watch the videos. A lot of times, I want to quickly browse and see if it's interesting. So I think you have to do both. For the people that do want the video, you've got a good pitch video, but you have to have that initial information there in a readable form, too.
I think that's true as well. You have to have not just an interesting video, but a compelling written pitch. And I think also you can help yourself by explaining a little bit about how the money will be used. I don't know per se that this is necessary, and you guys, of course, are free to chime in on this. But especially if it's a high amount, why you feel you need that amount and how it's going to be spent, so people have a little more confidence about bringing their money to the table. You know, they don't feel like they're getting ripped off.
I actually think you shouldn't tell people how you're spending the money. I don't think they care how you spend the money. I think I've seen a number of Kickstarters fail because people say, I'm going to spend the money on a cover here, and I'm going to spend the money on this guy over here, and I'm going to put some of the money in my pocket, or I'm going to use this to buy a new television set, or I'm going to put my kid in daycare so I can get the work done. That kind of stuff just opens you up for criticism about what you're doing, right? I think most Kickstarter backers care about what they're getting for their money, not what you're going to do with the money, unless the money is going directly into improving the product. Like, you know, let's hit the stretch goal and I'm going to make, this is going to now be in full color as opposed to black and white. Then they're going to be appreciating it. But you don't need to give them a breakdown of the budget to try to prove that you know what you're doing. They should assume that you know what you're doing by the way that you're telling them stuff and the way you're presenting stuff. If you have to actually do a line item budget to show people what you're doing, you're probably trying a little too hard.
Now, isn't though there a little bit of a danger on the flip side of that? I don't want to name the Kickstarter because of the fact that part of our show's basic setup is that we try to remain apolitical and irreligious, and this one was a political Kickstarter, or at least had political undertones to it. But there's a fairly well-known Kickstarter, and I'm just going to make up numbers here, but its original goal was something like 10 grand. The Kickstarter ended up raising 100 grand, and the person behind it opened themselves up to a lot of criticism. Now, I'm not going to say rightfully so or not, because that's not really the kind of judgment call I feel qualified to make, nor am I really interested in making on this show. But there was a fair amount of criticism that came in. It's like, well, what happened to the other 90 grand? You know, was that money just pocketed? I suppose the counter argument could be made, well, wait a minute. You backed at a certain level. You got your backer reward. If this person walked away with 90 grand in their pocket, that's really not per se your problem. But I've heard people argue that very fiercely the other direction of, hey, if people believed in you enough to give you this many times what you asked for, and there were not stretch goals already in place to account for that money, then you really kind of owe it to them to reinvest that back into what you offered in the first place, because that's why they backed it.
But, you know, I don't think that's true. I don't think that they backed it because they thought they were going to get more for their backing. They backed it based upon the reward they selected at the time. If you didn't tell them that they were going to get more for their money by giving them the money when they did, I don't think you have an obligation to say, and by the way, thank you so much, and here's some extra stuff. At a certain point, you have to say, I need to take some of this as profit, and I need to reinvest this in other things I'm doing. But just because you're asking people for money doesn't mean you have to open up your books to them and that you have to open up your entire life to them, which is a lot of times what happens with these people.
Yeah, I think what Matt's saying makes a lot of sense in a certain way. I mean, as long as you're being specific with people about what exactly they're getting for their money. So yeah, if you asked for 10 grand and you get $100,000, if people know what they're going to get out of the product, and if you're clear about, if you have stretch goals, what those stretch goals are and what they are going to receive and how it's going to improve, if you've planned that it's going to improve, then that's probably enough in terms of your responsibility. I mean, if you blow your total out of the water to that point, yeah, I mean, I probably would turn around and be like, you know, guys, that was really awesome. Here's something extra. But to be honest, I don't really think that Kickstarter creators have a responsibility to do that. Yeah, I mean, I think that if you were to make that a responsibility and assume that that's a responsibility, it does kind of blow it open.
Well, one thing that people don't seem to consider, too, is that if you have that many extra backers and that much extra money coming in, you're making more, if it's a physical product, this is. You're making more of the physical product than you originally were. Your costs just shot up.
Yeah.
So you need a lot of that money to go for that cost.
This is actually the last major point I want to hit on from the creator side before we go over here to the backers side. And I've got a topic that I think straddles the two worlds that'll help us transition that. But the last thing I want to talk about before I move off this, and Ryan, I'm going to push this one over to you because you love the number crunching. There's an obvious expense that's involved in running a Kickstarter. I was reading an article not that long ago. I think this was in The Economist, but I honestly don't remember. But it was about how people think about the cost of living, but don't think about the cost of working. They Yes. think about it costs me this much to live, but they don't think about in order to even have a job, it costs me this much in daycare, wardrobe, car, whatever, to actually hold down a job. And in the same way, when people set up a Kickstarter and start throwing out the rewards, they don't think about all of the different things that go into this. So I was wondering, could you give us a sense of the kinds of things you need to watch for? What are the percentages, for example, that Kickstarter takes? What percentages do Amazon take? What kinds of things do you have to look for in terms of, for example, if you're offering 5 books, if you back at the $100 level, actually paying for printing and shipping those 5 books?
I think this is one of the reasons that a lot of people get into big trouble when they run their first Kickstarter. Sometimes even their second and third Kickstarters. Running a Kickstarter is essentially an exercise in hope and marketing. But you're really, at the end of the day, you're creating a business. And running a company successfully at a profit is very difficult. And it's not the kind of thing that you usually get right the first time you try. And so what we see with a lot of Kickstarters are some very, very, very bad assumptions. And you've got a lot of disinformation floating around. You've got a lot of people who are best casing it. They have an idea of what something might cost, and maybe they heard from a friend of a friend about what it costs, and they're not really running very rigorous models. They're not calculating anything out on spreadsheets. They're just in the back of their mind kind of estimating their costs. So right off the bat, there's fees. So when you complete your Kickstarter, Amazon takes a fee and Kickstarter takes a fee. Kickstarter takes 5%. And Amazon takes up to 4%. I think it goes down as low as 3%, depending on how big your total amount pledged was. But you can roughly assume about 9% of the money that you had pledged never even gets to your bank account. Right off the bat, that whacks a lot of people in the head. They totally didn't understand that. And when they don't get that money, it causes them a huge problem. And then the next thing you really have to focus on is your shipping costs. And it's one of those things that people in the United States kind of take for granted, that we can ship stuff really inexpensively. But as soon as you go outside the borders of the United States, your shipping costs skyrocket. You know, shipping a box of stuff to Australia is going to cost $60. So if you have a pledge of $25 to send somebody a book, you just lost $30 on that deal. That was a money loser for you if you fulfill that deal. And then, you know, you really have your cost of goods for all the stuff that you manufactured for your Kickstarter. If you've never printed a book before or a boxed game before or a card game before, it can be way higher than you expected. You know, there's a lot of stories going around right now about a guy who did a board game. The board game wildly over-succeeded in terms of the amount of money pledged, but the guy made a bunch of mistakes in production and ended up costing himself almost as much money as he raised in the whole project just to get the thing printed and shipped. So at the end of the day, he broke even or lost a little bit of money. And those are not uncommon stories. You're not going to necessarily hear about all of them, but behind the scenes, you know, it's rampant. You know, Matt and I have been in the tabletop publishing business for a long time, and we know horror story after horror story after horror story of people who made really bad assumptions about cost of goods. But Kickstarter, that's even more magnified because you've already got their money and you've already got a promise to deliver. You can't just go back to your backers and say, oh, I screwed up. I need $30 more for you from shipping. I mean, you can ask, but there's no mechanism built into Kickstarter for you to get the money. It's a thing where I would advise anybody who is going to do a Kickstarter, especially if you're going to make physical products that have to be shipped somewhere, you need to sit down with Google. You need to research the weight of your project, the dimensions of your project, and figure out what it's going to cost to send that thing to various places. You need to sit down with somebody who's manufactured the kind of thing you want to make in the past, in the recent past, and talk with them about what it costs them to actually make that stuff all in. The proofing, the testing, the shipping of samples back and forth, the shipping of the finished goods back to you, wherever you may be. You know, there's just so many complications in production that you really need to understand that stuff. And you need to have a spreadsheet, and you need to document all those numbers. Ideally, you'd like to source those numbers from 3 or 4 different places so you can see if you're getting a good quote or not. There's just a lot of money things you have to take care of in order to make a Kickstarter be a success from a financial standpoint.
Right off the top, it's going to cost me $2,000 to produce this or that role-playing book. I'm just making up monies here, so let's just go with this. $2,000 to produce this book. But as you said, right, I'll start with 9% of that I'm losing off the top. So I need to actually inflate that $2,000 by an additional amount. If the backer rewards are going to be physical products or Bill Cavalier's used sweatbands or whatever it's going to be, you know, what is that going to cost me to put together and to ship out? And I know several people that actually end up losing money on their Kickstarters. And the reason they did so was they started with a basic premise of what does it cost me to make this product? What do I need to raise to create this? And that's what they went out and that's what they asked for. And they did not pad it for all these additional expenses. Now, certainly there's another edge to that sword, as I talked about before, which is especially if you're kind of new to this and you don't have much of a reputation or you don't have an idea which is going to go viral, which, by the way, is a terrible marketing plan, then you can very easily overreach yourself and say, well, to make the book and then to fulfill all these rewards and to take into account the percentages that come off from Kickstarter and then again from Amazon, instead of $2,000, I'm going to ask for $10,000. But because nobody knows my name, I raise $500 of that, and then the whole thing dies. Now, let me raise a related issue here. And I don't know if any of you guys actually know the answer to this. I believe the answer is yes, but I won't claim to know for sure. Though it's not typically reported, it is my understanding that the money earned from Kickstarter is actually taxable. And many people do not report and or pay those taxes. So fair warning on that. Talk to your accountant and do what you ought. I'm not going to give you any recommendations beyond that.
There's been some legitimate debate over that, I think. I've always booked everything as taxable, just as if somebody purchased something from me. I think that's the safest, smartest, and probably the most logical way to do it.
I think just getting back to that point about people sort of overreaching themselves as well, one sort of small point to bring up at the end there as well is once you're getting to the end of your Kickstarter, like Ryan was saying earlier, there's that tendency to bulk up your perk levels, bulk up your stretch goals, throw the kitchen sink at your donors in the attempt to try and get them to back you. And that's something that I've seen a lot of people hit at the end is this feeling like, oh my God, I have to give these people more so that they'll continue to back me. And they're not taking those new things into account in their budget. And all of a sudden they end up hitting their goal. Yeah, great. But now they've got some expenses they weren't planning for.
Here's my bridge topic. And I'm going to kick this one to Ryan, though. Any of you are free, of course, to comment on it. Just because I haven't heard the F word yet this episode. Ryan, could you talk about KickTrack?
Oh, I like KickTrack.
Oh, do you? This surprises me. Go on.
So KickTrack is a third-party website. It's operated by a guy who is not affiliated with Kickstarter in any capacity. He's not an employee. He doesn't work for them. Doesn't have any access to their data that you or I don't have. He built a tool that scrapes the Kickstarter website every day, and it essentially collects data on all the projects that are running that people have expressed an interest in. So a project doesn't show up in KickTrack until somebody goes to KickTrack and tries to look the project up. Once the first person tries to look it up, KickTrack will track that project until the project finishes. It actually provides a lot of visibility into the progress of a campaign that Kickstarter's own tools don't. As far as I know, like everybody who's doing a significant Kickstarter is using KickTrack every day because the data analysis tools that Kickstarter provides are minimal at best. One of the things that KickTrack does, which can create a problem for the project, is they create a projection, an estimated amount of money that they think the project, that KickTrack's algorithm thinks the project will raise based on the prior performance of your project and a bunch of voodoo that the guy who runs the site has created over time by analyzing thousands of completed projects. And the problem with the kick track projection is that if your kick track projection is showing that you will finish with a total that is less than your target goal, the community who may not understand all the nuances on what that kick track projection is showing may conclude that its word is gospel and you are going to fail. And so you can spend a lot of time trying to explain to people that the kick track projections are a rough at best estimate of what the project's final tally will be, and that in fact there's a lot of good reason to believe that they underestimate final totals in a certain class of cases, that class being where there is a substantial spike on the last day of the project.
Right.
Kick track projection does not do a good job of capturing the potential upside.
That's one of the things that I was going to point out, is the kick track projections are pretty much a straight line projection. They do take into account the early rush by virtue of that's where the data begins, but they don't seem to take into account that bimodality we talked about earlier, where there's that giant spike at the end. Now, I realize you can't per se predict that.
You never know who has Ted Freds with really good Visa cards.
Yeah, exactly. You don't know who Ryan has on speed dial. But and I realize, in fairness to Kick Track, it is somewhat hard to just presuppose, well, we're just going to guess that the spike at the beginning will repeat itself at the end, or maybe even be bigger than the spike at the beginning, and therefore we're just going to shoot this through the roof just to be safe. I realize that they can only work with the data that they have. And Ryan, to your point, all my jokes aside, I certainly do recognize that one of the great things KickTrack does offer is tracking the rate at which people are backing, the number of backers per day, the amount they're backing per day, the average amount they're backing at, so on and so forth. They give a lot of breakdowns to the math of the actual donations within Kickstarter. And I call this a bridge topic because I think this is something that, to someone who's running a Kickstarter, is a great way of getting a look into your Kickstarter. But once again, please don't let that line freak you out, because it does not take that in spike into account. But it does give you a sense in general of how people are responding to your Kickstarter. And if you are looking to back a Kickstarter, it gives you a way of kind of seeing how that Kickstarter is doing. Or once you've already backed, keeping track of kind of how it's doing over time. Because obviously, if you backed it, I'll presuppose you wanted it to succeed. I have talked to a few people who have said they intentionally back Kickstarters that won't succeed for weird reasons, but these are unusual individuals. The average person backs something they want to succeed, and so it does give kind of an odd look into it. And there were a couple Kickstarters where I watched them pretty closely on KickTrack just to see how they were doing. But let me move from that to something that is much more directly aimed at the backer and not at the creator, which is, how do you guys recommend spotting a scam? I've not heard from you in a little bit, so Tom, I'm going to kick this to you on, because you're a man who knows the heart of evil.
It's true. I don't know that I've actually encountered a scam intentionally.
Let me expand my definition here. Scam, to be a scam, is not just someone who's specifically lying to you, but someone who's also unlikely to deliver what was promised.
Right.
So let me go broad my definition a little bit.
Yeah. No, I mean, there are legitimate, and I mean, people who try to perpetrate scams. I mean, there was one recently that Kickstarter pulled the plug at the very last minute because it was pretty clear that what they were promising was not actually what they were delivering. But to your point, what I do to evaluate a project is, number one, do I know this person, or do they come recommended by a source that I'm familiar with? And I will say I get probably 95% of my Kickstarter recommendations over Twitter. I think a lot of people are like, Twitter, why would I bother? I don't have anything interesting to say. And there's so many fast-paced, dynamic conversations happening there that I really find it a valuable resource. So one, do I know somebody, or is it recommended by somebody? Number two, I really look at their goals, and I look at when they think they're going to deliver. So if they're asking for $50,000 and they haven't achieved anywhere close to that in the first 48 hours, I really get kind of skeptical, because in my opinion, other people backing is a sign of, you know, establishing that bank of trust that Matt referenced earlier. So I look at, you know, how many people are backing, what their funding level is, what their initial ask is, because if they're asking for a lot of money, I really have to trust them. Otherwise, I think they don't know what they're doing and they don't know how to budget something. And the other factor is, what are they trying to deliver and when do they think they're going to deliver it? I did back a project where they thought 2 months later they were going to deliver physical goods to us. And I was like, okay, you know what? Either you're on drugs or you don't know what you're doing, but I'm willing to roll the dice on this because it's just $30 and I really would like these things. But those are the major factors that I look for a scam is like, you know, what are the parameters, the initial parameters of the project? And then secondly, like how professionally is it presented? We talked about this earlier when we talked about the videos and stuff like that. It's very important to me, and it was certainly something that factored into my Kickstarter was let's have a compelling video, but me personally, I don't necessarily look at the video. The first thing I do is scroll down and I want the stretch goals to be very legible. I want everything to be laid out nicely. Did they invest time in getting a graphic designer to put together some custom graphics to trick out their page? Does it look like they've invested, you know, some effort into marketing this thing? Because there's nothing worse than like a one paragraph pitch and then the mandatory why Kickstarter is right for you text. And it's like, no, this guy's just phoning it in.
You know, as much as I gave my you can't just do the video speech, I will say if it's a web series, you better have a good video. Because if your final product is a video, I want to see what you could do with your catch video to catch my attention.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny. I've seen many people try to put together web series and they've never done anything before. Like we're talking about people who this is like they're jumping into Kickstarter for their first project and they put a half-assed, crappy, wiggly webcam video on for their Kickstarter pitch. And you just got to wonder what they're thinking, for sure. You know, if you've got a body of work behind you and I know what you can do and I've seen your stuff, then okay, you can get away with a very nice, very polished, talking head, really looks nice video, nicely color corrected, that kind of thing. I'm okay with that. But if you've never done anything before, you know, spend a little bit of time. Show me what you can do in the video, because if I don't think you can even make a 3-minute pitch video that looks enticing and amazing, then I don't think you can make a series.
Along the same lines, if you're a comic book, I want to see the art. If there's something you can show of the product right there yes. in that beginning, do it.
Give people a sense of what they're getting. And if you go to Kickstarter and you as a consumer do not have any sense of what you're getting, then I would start asking some hard questions because, as Wayne said, if this is going to be something like comic book or graphic novel, what does the art look like? What does the script look like? I mean, you're not expecting them to give away the whole farm here, but what's some sense of what this is going to be about? If this is a role-playing game, can you give me any details on how this is going to play? Joanna, I'm sitting here actually skimming over your Kickstarter right now, and I mean, it looks like you have, what, somewhere between like 6 and 8 videos on this thing, which...
We made so many videos.
Yeah, which coming from a Kickstarter where the primary value proposition is, of course, a video production, this shows yeah. what you intend to make and what you are capable of doing.
I wouldn't want to see that from a comic book, but from a web series?
Right.
Oh, yeah, that's a huge selling point.
Right.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. And we have a card game as well. We made sure that we had pictures of the cards up there. We have a web comic coming up, so we made sure we had pictures of the concept art, that kind of thing. It is really important. I mean, as a backer, if I'm looking at a campaign and I'm deciding whether or not I want a product, then it absolutely would tip me over the edge if I can see what I'm getting and I like what I see.
And I think it's worth noting here as a bit of caution, something that people need to be aware of is that as of right now, there is no method for retracting a donation that is made through these crowdfunding sites.
That's not exactly true.
I'm not aware of a way to do it like on Kickstarter.
So you can dispute the charge with Kickstarter. And I have one of these.
Hold on. Your product is estimated to be delivered in 2016.
Yes.
What is somebody disputing?
Yes. Well, they claim that representations were made to them during our Kickstarter that have since been altered, and that should invalidate their pledge. You can make a dispute with Kickstarter, and the first thing that Kickstarter does is send you a bunch of information about the dispute, and you get to respond to Kickstarter. And in fact, in the first case, Kickstarter accepted our argument that the product isn't going to be due until 2016, and so there was no basis for the person to dispute the fact that they hadn't got what they were promised. And then you can take it up with your credit card company. So credit card company then makes a charge to Amazon. Amazon makes a charge to your Amazon payments account. And then Amazon will contact you and tell you that for a $25 fee, they will represent your side of the case in a dispute with the credit card company. And then you have to decide if that's worth pursuing or not. In our case, it was totally worth it. And I assume, although it hasn't happened yet, although I think it probably will in this particular case, that the credit card company finds in our favor, that the backer could take us to small claims court and sue us in court over the amount.
I'm sorry to be putting you through that.
That's okay. I'm just saying that, you know, that there is this idea that you have no recourse.
No, I know.
There's at least two levels of recourse that are built into the system.
It sounds like there's no automated way to do it.
There's no easy way to do it, okay? That's a pain in the ass to the kind of things Ryan's talking about. You can do those, but you have to be pretty damn pissed off to actually start down that path.
I wouldn't do it for a $25 pledge, just for darn sure. A thing I wanted to mention on the topic we were just talking about, which is the fraud topic, and an interesting thing by its omission, is that if we were having this conversation a year or two ago, I think one of the things that we probably would have said, at least one of us would have said, is that they looked to see if the campaign had backed other projects on Kickstarter. And there used to be this idea that there was like a Kickstarter community, and that people who ran projects on Kickstarter needed to be a part of that community, and that they needed to be visible members of that community in backing other people's projects. But one of the problems with Kickstarter is that it doesn't really have the ability to have a corporate identity. So if you run a project on Kickstarter, it's assumed that you're a person. So we ran our projects under Goblinworks. Goblinworks is not a person. Goblinworks hasn't backed anything. I've backed more than a dozen projects. Lisa's backed a couple dozen projects. So we got a lot of people in our organization that back Kickstarter projects, but Goblinworks, the thing that is running our project, hasn't backed any. And I think that over the last year or so, that's actually become, I won't say common, but it's stopped being a thing. Nobody's going to look at our project and say, oh my God, they're a fraud. They've never backed a Kickstarter before. But that probably was the case a year ago. People would have probably made that comment.
I will say that that does factor into something where it's an independent person for me. If it's some guy in San Francisco who seems to be doing this out of his garage, I want to see whether he's backed projects or he's created other projects and whether they've successfully funded or not and what those projects were. Again, that speaks again to the bank of trust, to the reputation economy that's going on there.
So one thing I also think, and I know this is probably a topic you have listed, Dan, is after the Kickstarter is over, the communication with your backer helps me determine whether I would ever back another project by that same person. So I mentioned I've backed 10 projects or so. I've seen products from 3. So looking at some of the others, some of them are weekly updates. Some of them I haven't heard from in months. And I think that level of communication, that at least builds more trust with me.
Yeah.
So if you're telling me every step along the way, hey, we're going to miss our first date, here are the reasons why, but you're also just talking about your successes and I'm getting that constant communication,
yeah,
I'm much more likely to look at that as, okay, things like that happen in a project. I'm not going to let that influence whether I back your future projects or not.
Speaking here as a consumer, and I guess, well, it's the only way I could speak because I've actually never run a Kickstarter. I know many people that have, but I personally have yet to run one, and I'm not sure I ever intend to, but there's reasons for that that may or may not be relevant to this episode. But as someone who backs Kickstarters, I will say that certainly communication is very important to me because of the fact that it gives me a sense that the product is actually being created. Even if someone tells me, for example, let's take the most extreme case here. The 3 projects that I have backed right now that have yet to be delivered are the Fate 1 from Evil Hat, Wasteland 2, and Pathfinder Online. With all 3 of them, the one that is the farthest out on its delivery date is Pathfinder Online, which, Brian, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe is 2016. As a result, I know that that's going to be a while. But there is still this trait of human nature where if I don't hear anything and I don't see any movement, I start to get nervous. And on the flip side, if the person's talking to me, even if what they're telling me is things aren't working out quite how we'd hope, we're going to be a little bit behind schedule, we need to change things up a little bit. I mean, unless I feel like I'm being totally taken for a ride, I actually have a pretty good tolerance for that. And I would wager, and from kind of helping shepherd a few Kickstarters, I've observed it on those to be true as well, that as long as the person that's running it is talking and is talking honestly and genuinely, that most people seem to respond pretty well to that.
I can very much forgive lateness if, as long as you're telling me.
As long as you're telling me, yeah. And in the case of the Kickstarters that I'm backing right now, I don't know per se that any of them have had to explain lateness, but with all of them, I am getting regular check-ins. You know, in the case of Pathfinder Online, there are at least once a week, sometimes more than that, blog posts explaining various aspects of the game or exactly how the company is being operated or whatnot, really even look behind the curtains. With the Fate Kickstarter, I don't know if Fred who writes them personally or not, but I regularly get updates from them on where they're at and what they've got and what they're doing and what the current goals are. With Wasteland 2, you know, those guys are regularly sending out explanations of how they're going to handle aspects of the game, or in their case, because of the fact that it's a video game that's a little bit further along its production line, they've got demos they can show, clips of gameplay or some of the art assets or whatnot. And so they can show these very tangible things.
Yeah. When I look at the ones I don't have yet, Leisure Suit Larry is late. And I know exactly why it's late, because they've regularly contacted us and kept us up to date. There's a comic book that I backed that isn't even late yet, but I'm worried about it because I haven't heard a word from them since they sent out the surveys.
I think there is a flip side to this whole thing. I completely agree that it's important to communicate, you know, appropriately and in a timely fashion on what's going on, and especially to be honest about where you're at in the process and if things are going to be late. Explaining to people what's going on goes a long way to keeping the trust that you've built up. But I also backed a project where the guy sends us an update every week. And you know what? I don't need an update every week, because most of his content is a 2-minute video of him doing a magic trick and telling us about the other Kickstarter that he's running. And an, oh, by the way, this is why we're late. And he won't put any of the relevant information into the email, the written update that you get along with the, you know, the update. So I have to sit through this video and watch him do a magic trick and try to be entertaining, when that is not at all the reason why I backed. Like, I have to say, as a consumer, you can probably hear it, I resent that a lot. Like, I backed you for one specific thing. Don't use this marketing channel to now pimp me on a bunch of other stuff that is not relevant to the project. I understand there's some crossover, but like, that's all it is. There's really no update, guys. I haven't heard back from the factory. But by the way, here's a magic trick. No, I don't want that information.
I hate the video updates. I want the information in the email.
I think it can be in both. There's no reason it can't be in both. You know, if you want to do the video update, great. I mean, I think that's can be a nice value add. But the information I'm getting in an update after I've backed, please make things relevant to whatever project I backed. If you want to cross promote somebody else's KS because you believe in it, great, that can be one piece of it, but don't just use it as an opportunity to kind of use your own private YouTube channel. I find that distasteful.
Yes, I would absolutely agree that whatever communication is there ought to be relevant, at least loosely, you know, relevant, useful, on topic. I have never encountered what you just described, but I would be horrified if I did, because I think to some extent it would feel to me like taking my car in to get repaired, and while I'm sitting there trying to get the estimate from them, they will talk to me about anything but my car. And at some point I'm going to start to feel like I'm getting cheated here. Like, okay, what is it you're not telling me?
Except in this case, you've already paid to get your car repaired.
Yeah.
While they're repairing it, they're not talking about it.
Yeah.
And I think part of it is just, you know, the guy's a victim of his own success in that he raised a lot more money than he expected and, you know, it was a very successful project. And now he's like, well, why don't I just do this other stuff with it? And I can understand why he's trying to take advantage of what he's done, but he's kind of taking too much of it. He's exploiting what he's done rather than just leveraging it.
Yeah. I think that's where we're going to wrap this one up. I want to thank all of our guests for appearing. I really appreciate you guys taking the time to do this. Once again, going down the list, we have Joanna from Standard Action. You can find more information on what she does at standardaction.com. We have Matt Forbeck. You can find more information on his stuff at forbeck.com. You've got Ryan Dancy. You can find his stuff at goblinworks.com or find any of his lengthy diatribes on Facebook. And last but certainly not least, we have Tom Lommel, a.k.a. Bill Cavalier, the Dungeon Bastard. And that is what, dungeonbastard.com? Do I have that correct?
That is absolutely correct. Or you can also check us out at epicleveltv.com.
Okay. And with all of this stuff, as always, we will link all the relevant stuff in the show notes. So if you want to know where to find these four individuals and the excellent work that they are doing, then you can follow that off the show notes. And any of the stuff we referenced along the way, like KickTrack, the Kickstarter stats that I was working through, the CNN article, some of those promo videos we talked about, I will have all those links in the show notes that you guys can check those out and don't need to carve them into your arm as you're driving down the highway listening to this show. But anyways, once again, to our four guests, thank you guys very much for appearing on the show. I hope if you're listening, you'll take the time to check their stuff out, because we ask them on the show for a reason. We believe in what they're doing. We think that they're contributing excellent things to the culture and have a lot of interesting ideas, both creatively and in terms of the subject that we talked about here, which is Kickstarter. And whether you're thinking about starting a Kickstarter or backing one, I hope we've given you something to think about. So have a great week and great games, and we will catch you guys next time. This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2013. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.